Welcome to the Buddha Sasana Podcast. This talk was given by Bhikkhu Chintita in Austin, Texas.
This week, I want to finish talking about refuge. If you'll recall, last week, we were talking about refuge in the Dhamma, and I still have some things to say about that. The Kalama Sutta warns us not to see certainty in one's thinking or in much of anything else. Come, Kalamas, do not go upon what has been acquired by repeated hearing, nor upon tradition, nor upon repetition, nor upon what is in scripture, nor as a result of thought, nor upon an axiom, nor upon careful reasoning, nor out of delight in speculation, nor upon another's seeming ability, nor upon the thought, the monk is our venerable teacher. Kalamas, when you yourselves know these things are good, these things are not blamable, these things are praised by the wise, undertaken as a whole, these things lead to benefit and happiness, then enter and abide in them. The formula for recollecting the Dhamma suggests that there is a degree of effort in verifying the Dhamma against experience, since the Dhamma is personally experienced by the wise. The Buddha invites us to come and see ehipasiko in the formula, but when he says come, he is shouting down to us flatlanders from the mountaintop. To arrive at his vantage point, we need to scramble up hills, struggle through brambles and ford creeks. When the Buddha says see, we need to focus our eyes intently in the right direction to barely make out what the Buddha sees with great clarity of vision. In order to be willing to do all of this, we have to establish from the beginning trust that the Buddha knew what he was talking about. This is refuge. What else would induce us to make the difficult climb up the mountain? Investigation and personal verification are necessary parts of following the Dhammic path, but they take time and effort before we can say, I have come and now I see. Until then, trust is essential. Come is based on trust, and see is the eventual verification in our own experience. For instance, the Buddha taught that craving is the origin of suffering, the second noble truth. At first, this may seem, at least to some, like an abstract proposition, which we must ponder and try our darndest to match up with observation. The most likely hasty outcome is to dismiss this proposition as simply mistaken. It seems pretty clear to us, for instance, that buying that snazzy shirt we so want would make us exceedingly dashing, and that would lead to improved prospects for romance and other forms of social and perhaps even business success. Therefore, we conclude craving clearly leads not to suffering, but to happiness. However, refuge entails that instead we decide to trust the Dhamma before we draw naive or premature conclusions from our own experiences. Eventually, perhaps after years of investigation on and off the cushion, we might discover that the second noble truth is not an abstraction at all. It's something that bites us on the nose over and over all day, every day. We begin to notice that as soon as craving comes up, the suffering is right behind it. In fact, as soon as we have to have that snazzy shirt, there is stress and anxiety, unmistakably. We might discover we have been living in a world of incessant suffering, a world aflame all along without noticing it. In brief, faith, what we trust to deal with uncertainty, bears a close relationship to wisdom, what we see for ourselves. We can plot the relation like this. Faith or trust gives rise to practice, and practice gives rise to wisdom. The Dhamma also stands out in how loosely it is held. When we have faith in the Dhamma, this does not mean that we believe the Dhamma, rather that we accept it in the sense that we take it seriously, at least as a working assumption. In fact, notice that in the passage from the Kalama Sutta, the ultimate criterion for evaluating a teaching is ethical or practical, that is, whether practice on the basis of the teaching is of benefit. In the Chunki Sutta, we learn that anything accepted through faith, approval, oral tradition, reasoning, or pondering may or may not turn out to be true. At this, the young Brahmin Chunki asks us then how truth is to be preserved. If a person has faith, his statement, this is my faith, preserves the truth. But he doesn't yet come to the definite conclusion that only this is true, anything else is worthless. To this extent, Bharadvaja, there is the preservation of truth. To this extent, one preserves the truth. I describe this as the preservation of the truth, but it is not yet a discovery of the truth. The Buddha then reports this formula with regard to a person who approves something, who holds an oral tradition, who has reasoned something through analogy, or who has views he has pondered out, just as with regard to a person who has faith. Nothing is believed unconditionally, and so blind faith cannot arise under the Buddha's instructions. The Buddha then shows how truth is discovered and then finally realized, the implication being that if a correct teaching is accepted as a working assumption, it will eventually be seen directly, that is, known for oneself with wisdom, as one's practice progresses. This passage is a remarkable illustration of the care the Buddha accorded faith and other ways of accepting beliefs that fall short of realization in direct experience. We are not to take these as conclusive, but rather to keep their context and thereby their provisional nature in mind. We're asked to accept them as no more than working assumptions. Nonetheless, some assumptions should be accepted and others not. The criterion is in terms of human benefit, not in terms of absolute truth. The Buddha gives us an example. There are some contemplatives and Brahmins who hold this doctrine, hold this view. There is nothing given, nothing offered, nothing sacrificed. There is no fruit or result of good or bad actions. There is no this world, nor next world, no mother, no father, no spontaneously reborn beings, no Brahmins or contemplatives who, faring rightly and practicing rightly, proclaim this world and the next after having directly known and realized it for themselves. These views deny almost every teaching regarding Buddhist life that we have visited here. He then points out how these views are likely to condition the behavior of such contemplatives and Brahmins. It can be expected that they will adopt and practice these three unskillful activities: bad bodily conduct, bad verbal conduct, bad mental conduct. Why is that? Because those venerable contemplatives and Brahmins do not see in unskillful activities the drawbacks, the degradation, and the defilement, nor in skillful activities the benefit of renunciation as cleansing. Here is the kicker. People of this view cannot win whether or not their view turns out to be true in the end. Assume there is no other world regardless of the true statement of those venerable contemplatives and Brahmins. This good person is still criticized in the here and now by the observant as a person of bad habits and wrong view, one who holds to a doctrine of non-existence. If there really is a next world, then this venerable person has made a bad throw twice, in that he is criticized by the observant here and now, and in that with the breakup of the body after death, he will reappear in a plane of deprivation, a bad destination, a lower realm, hell. Thus, this incontrovertible teaching, when poorly grasped and poorly adopted by him, covers one side. He gives up the skillful option. Fundamentally, this describes a purely pragmatic condition for accepting one of two alternative theses on the basis of a kind of cost-benefit analysis, or a means of covering one's bets, that by itself justifies its acceptance as a kind of working assumption. The Buddha then makes a similar argument in the Kalama Sutta with regard to realizing the fruits of kamma in the next life. It's clear that he recommends that kamma and rebirth be accepted as working assumptions by the skeptical, but is confident that their truth, which he endorses, will eventually be discovered and finally realized in the diligent practitioner's own experience. So far, we've had a lot to say about the qualities of the Dhamma, but little about the practice of refuge in the Dhamma. Perhaps the most thorough way to venerate the Dhamma is to put it into practice and, over time, repeatedly verify aspects of the Dhamma in our own experience. For these teachings are profound and wise. As its track record becomes established, our trust will naturally grow, and with that, the depth of our practice, and accordingly, the rate of continued verification. Additionally, memorization of scriptures is perhaps the most ancient way of venerating the Dhamma. Physical books did not exist in the early Buddhist period, but treating these with great care alongside memorization became a natural part of practice in later traditions. Refuge in the Sangha. The formula for recollecting the Sangha is as follows. The Sangha of the Fortunate One's disciples is practicing the good way, practicing the straight way, practicing the true way, practicing the proper way, that is, the four pairs of persons, the eight kinds of individuals. The Sangha of the Fortunate One's disciples is worthy of gifts, worthy of hospitality, worthy of offerings, worthy of reverential salutations, the unsurpassed field of merit for the world. Refuge in the Sangha is trust in the living representatives of the Buddha, those who understand, embody, impart, and maintain Dhamma. They, like the Buddha and Dhamma, are sources of Buddhist wisdom worthy of veneration. Who are these people, and how do we recognize them? The definition of the Sangha is ambiguous, apparently deliberately so, sometimes seeming to refer to what is known as the Noble Sangha, Arya Sangha, whose membership is determined by progress on the path, and sometimes seeming to refer to the Monastic Sangha, Bhikkhu Sangha, easily recognizable by their robes and bald heads. We have met and visited with the monastics already, but let me briefly introduce the Noble Ones, or Noble Sangha, at this point. The two sanghas have a substantial overlap, but are not identical. The four pairs of persons referred to in the sangha recollection have to do with the stream enterers, the once returners, the non-returners, and the arahants. These are people who have reached progressive stages of awakening through following the path. The last, the arahants, is full awakening, and the others can be regarded as different degrees of partial awakening. All are graduates from the ranks of mere worldlings, patujana, to noble ones. For each of these stages, we further distinguish between the path and the fruit. For instance, those on the path to stream entry are not yet stream enterers, but are on the path of training that is coming to a close. Stream enterers per se enjoy the fruit. This Dhamma Vinaya is the abode of such mighty beings as stream enterers, and those practicing to realize the fruit of stream entry. Once returners and those practicing to realize the fruit of once returning, non-returners and those practicing to realize the fruit of non-returning, arahants and those practicing for arahantship. This is a bit complex, but this is what gives us the four pairs of persons, the eight types of individuals in the recollection of the Sangha. So this passage seems to refer to the noble Sangha. However, worthy of gifts, worthy of hospitality, worthy of offerings, seems to refer to monastics. Recall from earlier talks that worthy recipients of generosity are ascetics and Brahmins, that is, those dependent on alms. Ascetics and Brahmins of high attainment, we should recall, are fertile fields of merit. So there is indeed an intentional ambiguity between the two types of Sangha. My own theory is that the Buddha, in implicitly equating the two groups, was asking monastics to resolve to become noble ones, and was asking noble ones to ordain as monastics, if they haven't already. The whole point of refuge in the Sangha is to establish a deferential and ongoing relationship to an important source of Buddhist wisdom. This might be implemented individually by establishing a relationship to a teacher. However, early Buddhism did not articulate the role of teachers apart from the Buddha himself, but instead extolled the admirable friend, Kalyanamitta, a wise person who can perhaps provide teachings, but also from whom we can learn by emulating his conduct and who provides inspiration in the Dhamma overall. In general, those of higher attainment or spiritual progress are those from whom we are likely to learn the most. The importance of the admirable friend is expressed in the following curious but well-known passage. As he was seated to one side, Venerable Ananda said to the fortunate one, "This is half of the holy life, Lord, having admirable people as friends, companions, and colleagues." "Don't say that, Ananda, don't say that. Having admirable people as friends, companions, and colleagues is actually the whole of the holy life. When a monk has admirable people as friends, companions, and colleagues, he can be expected to develop and pursue the Noble Eightfold Path." Admirable friends put us right on the path, a topic of future talks. The Sangha is a source of admirable friends for worldlings, for these are where we are likely to find people advanced or even perfected in virtue and in understanding, virtuous, serene, and wise. These tend to be the contemporary teachers and protectors of the Dhamma. members of the Sangha themselves are expected to seek out admirable friends, ideally of even higher attainment. A monastic may or may not be a noble one, and a noble one may or may not be a monastic. However, both kinds of Sangha are intimately connected in that the monastic Sangha is the natural home of the noble ones, and the noble Sangha is largely a product of the monastic institution. We've seen that the monastic Sangha provides an ideal context for Buddhist practice by defining the life most conducive to upholding Buddhist principles, a life so barren of any opportunity for personal advantage that a self can scarcely find anything to do, though it might continue for a time to haunt the mind. Into this life flow wisdom and compassion that, liberated from the tyranny of personal neediness, burst here and there into the various stages of awakening. As an ascetic renunciate community, monks and nuns depend completely on material support from the lay community. Not only does this afford the monastic the leisure of practice, study, and accomplishing good, but it insulates the monastic from the ups and downs of the contingencies and from competitiveness of the common world. In this way, the monastic Sangha, as long as it follows the discipline scrupulously, tends to produce noble ones of progressively higher attainment from among its ranks. The flourishing of the monastic Sangha in this way ensures the flourishing of the noble Sangha as well. The Buddha stated, If monks should live this life to perfection, the world should not lack for arahants. The world will even less lack for noble ones still aspiring to become arahants. The monastic Sangha is therefore both training ground and dwelling place for the noble Sangha, much like a university is both training ground and dwelling place for scholars. Noble ones, in turn, ennoble the general Buddhist community. Just as it benefits us to have artists and good plumbers among us, or those educated in the humanities, it ennobles us to have saints and sages, adepts and arahants in our midst. The more, the better. These noble ones, disciples of the Buddha, who root their lives entirely in the Dhamma and are an inspiration and resource for us all, constitute an effective civilizing force. Where there are noble ones, faith will be inspired, for they display firsthand the peace and happiness, wisdom and compassion that result from complete immersion in the Buddhist life. The noble ones are close at hand. They teach, they inspire with their deportment, their good works, and their knowledge. They inspire self-reflection concerning one's own life and tend to dispel samsaric tendencies. They keep the flame of the Buddha's teaching alive. It's through these admirable friends that the meaning of the Buddha's life and awakening is revealed, and through these admirable friends that the highly sophisticated teachings of the Dhamma are clarified step by step to lead the instructling toward and along the path. Keeping the flame of the Dhamma burning bright is critical for the perpetuation of the teachings in their full integrity. Because those teachings are so subtle and sophisticated, they are easily misinterpreted and corrupted if they are not put into practice and experienced by the noble ones among us. Finally, many of the same physical expressions of veneration that applied to the Buddha were also applied to the monastic Sangha in his day and continue to be applied in the present day. Because of their formal status in the Buddhist community, the monastic Sangha also symbolizes the noble Sangha, and therefore spiritual attainment and the Buddhist movement at large. For it is the Sangha that has preserved the essential core of the Dhamma and has transmitted it for 100 generations. The practice of refuge. To practice trust in the Triple Gem is to open your heart and mind to the influence of the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. The point is not to put discernment aside. Indeed, you want with time to verify point by point for yourself what these sources of wisdom have to teach until trust is no longer necessary. The point is to listen attentively to what these sources have to teach you, to consider them seriously, and to make them the basis of your own investigation. Refuge opens the mind. Blind faith is its closing. Refuge is necessary for entering the path. Refuge comes with vow, a series of bold commitments to live and practice in a certain way, a determination that this will be the shape of your life. We've seen that veneration for the Buddha was clearly expressed in the early sources. He understood that without such deference, he was wasting his time talking to an unreceptive audience. Likewise, reverence for the Dhamma for many years after the Buddha was naturally enacted in the effort to recite, remember, and preserve his words. Deference toward the Sangha is, in a sense, easier because it applies to the only living gem and therefore assumes a particularly personal quality. The reverence for the monastic component of the Sangha dovetails with the project of satisfying their material needs, a root lay practice of generosity discussed in earlier talks. Monastics were also recipients of many of the same kinds of physical expression of respect accorded to the Buddha during his life, and likewise see in those who show proper reverence a fruitful field of merit. One of the issues we encounter in Western cultures is the sparseness of the monastic Sangha. Nonetheless, there are many highly qualified lay teachers. Think of them as Sangha and treat them with respect. Refuge is often a physical practice. To bow to the Buddha is to enact reverence for the Buddha. To enact reverence for the Buddha is to feel reverence for the Buddha. To feel reverence for the Buddha is to put aside one's presuppositions and open one's heart to the teachings of the Buddha. To do this is to align with the Buddha's path. We tend to be dismissive of reverence in modern and certainly American culture. And yet reverence is recommended by the Buddha. You'll be surprised to learn how much power there is in bowing. This is the end of my series of talks on Buddhist life. Sometime in the near future, I'll give a series of talks in the Buddhist path. Starting next week, I'm going to talk about the Buddha's teachings on dependent co-arising. So I hope you'll attend those talks as well. Thank you.